Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we're doing Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. So if you actually kind of follow the timeline, we started prior to the Revolution, prior to the Declaration of Independence, which kicked off the Revolution. We started with the Tory Acts because that was when the states started organizing, or I should say the colonies started organizing and kind of saying, hey, we can't do this, we can't allow this to happen. And what we've been doing is we've been really laying out, I think, a good historical perspective of what they were going through and, you know, how determined they are or were, and how determined we need to be in galvanizing liberty. So where we are today, we just wrapped up Hamilton's plan. So we covered the Virginia plan, we've covered the Pinckney plan, now we've covered the Hamilton plan. And so what we're going to dive in today, you know, and actually I'm going to tell you something, this is really a discovery. I mean, I've kind of skimmed through these notes, reading them for the first time. That's what we got right now. And I'm sure that that was the same when Paul was reading them as well. As a matter of fact, I think he attested to that. And so we miss Paul. It's nice having somebody else, you know, reading and helping with this process. But all things being equal, what we've got today is we're going to read the responses from those who were in the room the day after Hamilton presented his plan. He took a whole day in standing up there, providing theory. And as a matter of fact, Madison didn't really write everything down because Madison kind of summarized in, you know, a single line, you know, that he was kind of presenting this kind of attitude. Like there at one point, you know, he seemed frustrated. So I don't know, because I do not have the published book that Madison had done, but I'm going to presume that it was a little bit more comprehensive instead of dealing with a lot of the shorthands and those types of things. Like in here, he calls Mr. Patterson Mr. P and so forth, and he uses a lot of different abbreviations. But before I get into this, the one thing I wanted to share is starting on Monday next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we are going to re-air my episodes I recorded last year regarding a constitutional president. In other words, only a constitutional president could really make a difference. If we continually get politicians in, I'm going to tell you, a constitutional governor could really make a difference. A constitutional executive could really make a difference. Because if he stands up, and if you vote, this is why I've completely divorced myself from any of the executive types of candidates and so forth, and I will not endorse one unless they've committed to actually being a constitutional executive. They have a lot of authority and power to enforce the law. And so when you've got, you know, a communist actually doing rebellion against the Constitution, like Jay Inslee, and I mean literally violating the Constitution left and right, and his henchman is the Attorney General. However, if you have a constitutional governor, that governor could actually utilize a good constitutional general attorney. Now, here's the thing. The Secretary of Justice, or the, you know, the Justice Department, the Secretary of the Department of Justice has, you know, as is beholden to the president because that's an appointment. Most people like the idea of having a elected attorney general. Now, so here's the problem. You could actually, create a, I'll just say, opposition. And this is why it's far more important to actually use electors instead of having these guys run campaigns. I mean, I'm okay with an elector actually selecting, because they should actually be giving you the most constitutional candidate there. But I'm not convinced that the attorney general position is an adequate position, because the attorney general should actually report and support the Constitution underneath the governor, just like the Department of Justice, the secretary for the Department of Justice. So anyway, I think that the design at the federal level was just so spot on. This is why it needed to be duplicated at the state and the county. But anyway, starting on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then the following week would be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then the following week will be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then we'll probably either air the last one on that Friday, because we got 13 shows. So we get 4 done a week, and that means we get 3 weeks of going through this. Now, I'm going to go through all of the different slants of, foreign affair, economy, those types of things. And I kind of cover this to ad nauseum, but I think it's very important to make sure that we bring up all these different points, these ancillary issues of what a constitutional president could really do and how a constitutional president could be a leader. He doesn't have the authority to undo everything, but he can enforce the Constitution. The problem is he needs to make sure that the states actually do their job in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. That's the state's responsibility. He can't do that. I mean, even if you had a constitutional president and actually scuttled everything and said, okay, I've done what was necessary, the next president can come right back and resurrect all of that at the behest of an unconstitutional Congress. Now, anyway, I dive through all of this stuff so that you really understand what you need to be looking for in a leader who leads us down the right road. We don't have kings or emperors in America. We do not have dictators with full sovereignty. We have a completely different system. This is why I keep telling you the doctrine of magistrates is not invoked here, not least not underneath our Constitution. Our Constitution was designed with a bottom-up paradigm. So you have to start demanding that you're only going to vote for those people who are constitutional. I know what you're saying. I know exactly what you're saying. You're going, oh, well, we don't have anybody doing, that's actually supporting the Constitution, so I'm going to vote for the next best thing. And that's an indictment. That's an indictment that we're not getting people into these races to do that. That's why it's so important to start at your county. If we start at the county, we're going to have, 20, maybe 20-some thousand candidates throughout the nation that are actually cutting their teeth in demanding full support to the Constitution, which creates a lot of opportunity to the state and federal level. Because once you get some really good leaders, and I mean really strong leaders on the Constitution, well, there's no reason why they're not at the state level or even at the federal level. See my point? This is how we nurture and develop locally. This is how we you want to call it farm raise, grass feed, whatever. Anyway, let me get into the convention. This is Tuesday, June 19th, 1787. And so the committee of the whole kind of all gets situated and they all sit down. And so Mr. Patterson's plan, again, at large, before he put his plan up there again, for the committee. So Mr. Madison stressed and had laid by some gentlemen on the want of power in the convention to propose any other than a federal plan. To what had been answered by others, He would only add that neither the characteristics attached to a federal plan would support this objection. One characteristic was that in a federal government, the power was exercised not on the people individually, but on the people collectively, on the states. In other words, the federal government didn't have a direct relationship with you, the people. Now, oh, by the way, you know, we talk about, you know, this, the direct tax and so forth. And, you know, as we go through the taxation and all of that, if you actually look at Section 9 of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, no capitation other than direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Now, I'm going to go to just, you know, because this is kind of important because a lot of people talk about this. So they don't identify what part other than Article 1, Section 8 that the 16th Amendment touches. And I defy anybody to say, hey, hold on here. This didn't change Article 1, Section 9, because what this says is the Congress will have power to lay and collect taxes. Now, there's no boogeyman here regarding unlimited spending. It doesn't mean that they can tax for things that are not authorized. This is only the mechanism of taxing to fund legitimate government. Nowhere in what I'm going to read will tell you, you can do whatever you want to do, like what everybody tells you that the 16th Amendment says. It's not here. Show me. Just point it out to me where that magical clause is in this, literally, just a few words. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So they talk about Article 1 and these different spots, and I know that this kind of changes, but they didn't do a very good job, and the one thing that they didn't address is uniformity. There's nowhere here where they talk about uniformity, but I will tell you that because Article 1, Section 9 clearly protects the states and the people from any other type of direct tax other than that type, the question is, and this is why I need to really go back because I've never pulled in the Congressional Globe, but just by the language itself, everybody that's running around like chickens with their heads cut off about the 16th Amendment to the 17th Amendment, they've really taken away out of context. There's not that much power given other than a change of taxation or other than a change of choosing your senator. But anyway, I digress. So the design was, and I do realize that this direct tax changed this mechanism that Madison was talking about. One characteristic was that in the federal government, the power was exercised not on the people individually, but this direct tax changed that. However, the direct tax did not authorize the federal government to create a federal bureaucracy of enforcing their own laws. As a matter of fact, if there was going to be an enforcement, it had to be done by the militia. And so the question was, would they really need to stand up a permanent IRS, or would they just actually be forced to create a system? And had they followed the uniformity clause, which is what's required, then it literally becomes a lot easier because you don't have any loopholes. You don't have any, you know, deductions and all this other crap. Everybody just pays a flat 2%, 5%, whatever. That's it. Whatever is needed, because this whole process of deductions and all of those types of things creates a disparity, and it basically changes the concept of uniformity, that the burden should be equal to all. Well, to be clear, you know, what the federal government does not have the authority to do, and we kind of have covered this before, they do not have the ability to start creating favors and or advantages for certain people because they have more affluence and more money. They can bury it easier. Anyway, moving on, this is what Madison says. Yet in some circumstances, in piracies, captures, etc., the existing Confederacy, and in many instances, the amendments to it proposed by Mr. Patterson, must operate immediately on individuals. The other characteristic was that the federal government derived its appointments not immediately from the people, but from the states, which they respectively composed. Here, too, were facts on the other side. In two of the states, Connecticut and Rhode Island, the delegates to Congress were chosen not by the legislature, but by the people at large. And the plan of Mr. Pinckney's, no, there's no change in this particular area. He doesn't say area, but I'm just adding that. In this particular, it had been alleged by Mr. Patterson that the, and I said Pinckney, it's Mr. Patterson, that the Confederation, having been formed by unanimous consent, could be dissolved by unanimous consent only. Does this doctrine result from the nature of compacts? Does it arise from any particular stipulation in the Articles of Confederation? Let me just repeat what he's talking about. This is really, really important because most people thought that unanimity was a hardcore requirement. As a matter of fact, the concept of the anti-conventionites, think about this. They're saying that everything had to be, you had to have a unanimous decision. They were all tied. It was, and this goes down to a conversation I'm going to tell you about later this week that I had with a self-proclaimed, I'm using a little license here, but a self-proclaimed professor, I mean, this gentleman referred to himself as a professor of organic law, and he talked about how compacts are perpetual. And I am here to tell you, Madison states completely differently. As a matter of fact, he talks about the Articles of Confederation for the Perpetual Union, and he's basically going to lay it out that the fundamental tenets of contract law, nobody, no one can be conscripted when a contract is being violated. You're not conscripted to a contract to be abused and have that contract actually change and morph beyond what you signed up for. And he basically, he says this in the Federalist Papers too, a violation against one clause, one minor part of the contract, it basically nullifies the entire contract if necessary. It is up to the individual party to determine if that violation is cause enough to actually void the contract and step back. This is why the whole point of nullification, and when somebody says we're going to nullify something, and why the doctrine of single state nullification in this form of a union, in the form of our current U.S. Constitution for the United States, single state nullification and a state actually doing that and staying in the union is an abomination. This is Madison's words. This is why we went through this before. But anyway, I'm going to repeat this. It had been alleged by Mr. Patterson that the Confederation, having been formed by unanimous consent, could be dissolved by and consent, or he says consent only, I'm going to say it in front, could only be dissolved by unanimous consent. He actually puts the only at the end. Does this doctrine result from the nature of compacts? Does it arise from any particular stipulation in the Articles of Confederation? If we consider the Federal Union as analogous to the fundamental compact by which the individuals compose one society, and which must, in its theoretic origin at least, have been the unanimous act of the component members, it cannot be said that no dissolution of the compact can be effected without unanimous consent. And this is where he says this, and he says this several times in the Federalist Papers. A breach of the fundamental principles of the compact by a part of the society would certainly absolve the other part from their obligations to it. If the breach of any article by any of the parties does not set the others at liberty, it is because the contrary is applied in the compact itself. In other words, you're conscripted and you can't get out of it. And particularly by that law of it, which gives an indefinite authority to the majority to bind the whole in all cases. This later circumstance shows that we are not to consider the Federal Union as analogous to the social compact of individuals, for if it were so, a majority would have a right to bind the rest and even to form a new constitution for the whole, which the gentleman from New Jersey would be among the last to admit. If we consider the Federal Union as analogous not to the social compacts among the individual men, but to the conventions among the individual states, what is the doctrine resulting from these conventions? Clearly, according to the expositor of the laws of nations, that a breach of any one article by any one party leaves all the other parties at liberty to consider the whole convention as dissolved, unless they choose rather to compel the delinquent party to repair the breach. He's teaching you right here, folks, what has to happen. The states have to force the federal government into compliance to their compact. In some treaties, indeed, it is expressly stipulated that a violation of particular articles shall not have this consequence, and even that particular articles shall remain in force during war, which in general is understood to dissolve all subsisting treaties. But are there any exceptions to this to the Articles of Confederation? So far from it, that there is not even an express stipulation that force shall be used to compel an offending member of the Union to discharge its duty. Remember, we went through these amendments that they put. That's why we're not going past a stone without uncovering it. We're showing you all of the facts. And basically, there is nothing in the Articles of Confederation that bound anybody, none of the states, to that article, the Articles of Confederation. And yet we hear, oh no, that was perpetual. You can't change that. By the way, just to be clear, I'm going to pause. When we look at these contrived terms of law, we need to be mindful that they're contrived. There are fundamental laws. Contract law is a fundamental law that goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. Actually, it goes all the way back to heaven, because a compact, contract, covenant, they're basically the exact same thing, where you have basically signed away. Now, in a spiritual sense, you're signing away at a spiritual level. In a financial sense, you're signing away some financial with collateral or what have you. Doesn't mean you're going to be cast into hell. but my point is that there are fundamental laws, and one fundamental law is civil law, and another fundamental law is common law. And common law is derived by the supreme law. And in England, one of the fundamental supreme law was the Bible and the king. And so there was always this, I'll just say, this contest between whether the king, you know, morally could do that or not. The problem with the Bible is, one, it can be reinterpreted, or you can bring in a different Bible, unless you've canonized it. In England, they canonize, but still, nonetheless, it is so ambiguity. The ambiguity, I don't mean to say it this way, but bottom line, there's this, you go down this path of interpretation. And when you go down the path of interpretation, you actually leave yourself vulnerable in a big way to how that, you know, how you're going to a line to that passage or what have you. And if the if it's not protected, that's what one of the reasons why the Bill of Rights was so important, to actually cover everything. But back in the days when they did that, they didn't even think about technology and saving themselves or protecting themselves from technology. We're going into a break. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so getting back to what Madison is really driving here, he's really helping, I think, everybody start to understand that the way these, and as a matter of fact, under the new Constitution, folks, under the new Constitution, and I'm not talking about the 1800 new Constitution. I'm talking about this new Constitution that they're bringing into this fold, that they're in the process of designing. And so, and the reason why I want to go through this is because here Madison actually says some things that are pretty clear. The question is, and I believe Madison has the integrity, if somebody actually challenges him, that's going to be put into his notes. Because he was that kind of person. I mean, you know, he was not a man that thought the whole universe evolved around him like Hamilton. And as a matter of fact, there's no doubt in my mind, I would not trust any, I hate to say this because I'm really prejudging this man, but I don't think that I would trust anything that he wrote in his journals. I don't know if he actually had an honest journal. I don't know. I just think that because he was so controlled, he was so manipulative that I just think that he was lying in his own journals and so forth, just so he would get caught in his lies. So anyway, so as Madison, I'm going to kind of reread this. In some treaties, indeed, it is expressly stipulated that a violation of particular articles shall not have this consequence. He's talking about, you know, dissolving, if, you know, one little thing and it dissolves the whole thing. And even that particular article shall remain in force during war, which in general is understood to dissolve all subsisting treaties. But are there any exceptions of this sort to the Articles of Confederation? So far from it that there is not even one express stipulation that force shall be used to compel any offending member of the Union to discharge its duty. He observed that violations of the federal articles have been numerous and notorious. Among the most notorious was an act of New Jersey herself by which she expressly refused to comply with the constitutional requisition of Congress and yielded no further to the expostulations of their deputies than barely to rescind her vote of refusal without passing any positive act of compliance. He did not wish to draw any rigid inferences from these observations. In other words, I'm not really judging you. I'm just basically pointing out that, you know, you guys got away with not having to do anything because there was nothing, you couldn't be compelled. He thought it proper, however, that the true nature of the existing Confederacy should be investigated, and he was not anxious to strengthen the foundations on which now it stands. In other words, Madison found so many flaws that it really needed this, let's call it a makeover, this new constitution, this new government. Folks, I know that some of you run across people that go, we got to get back to the Articles of Confederation. When you glance over that, who's saying that, you know, or when you're looking at, you know, if it's a post or if it's, you know, something, look at the byline, look at the name of that person, because you need to make note that this person is either an imbecile or a very nefarious person. Because in a civil society, it requires, in a Republican form of government, it requires well-founded law and the rule of law, the obedience to the law. And as Madison just points out, that the law that they had was not even firm, nor was it, nor could it actually be the rule of law. It was the rule of suggestion. Well, we suggest that you do these things. We suggest, we said here that you had to do these things, you know, because if you read the Articles of Confederation, they actually say they'll put these requisitions out. You're going to, and you will provide. But there was nothing in it that said, oh, well, if you don't, then we'll be able to use force, which is one of the reasons why the amendment was given to give them force. And it was refused. In other words, it was a very childish compact, and it was so easily exploited that even Madison, we all know about Rogue Island, but even Madison pointed to the person that was basically insisting that we kind of stick to this plan, because this plan is the closest, and it dovetails. It just, you know, interfaces well with the Articles of Confederation. And here he says that he was not anxious to strengthen the foundation on what that thing stands. Proceeding, and this is him going on, he says, proceeding to the consideration of Mr. Patterson's plan, he stated the object of a proper plan to be twofold. One, to preserve the Union, and two, to provide a government that will remedy the evils felt by the states, both in their united and individual capacities. Examine Mr. P's plan or Mr. Patterson's plan and say whether it promises satisfaction in these respects. One, will it prevent those violations of the laws of nation and of treaties, which if not prevented, must involve us in the calamities of foreign wars? Ah, he just gave us the real reason why it was important to observe the laws of nations. Which is why in the way they actually treated when they went into the territories, before, you know, even though they were U.S. territories, they still, this was British's, this was baked in Britain. Let me just stop right here, because this is something that came to me that I need to share, because I know a lot of people look at how evil we were. And there were men, but not our law. There were men that were absolutely evil that killed, you know, Native Americans, Indians, whatever you want to say, and as well as other people, blacks. You know, we've had just notorious, I mean, infamous men that have done just atrocities with different demographics of people, whether they be living here in North America or what have you. But that was not done by sanction of the Constitution. But I want to point something out, that as we looked at America and as we looked at how things were going to be managed, as far as, you know, whether, you know, who would have been the better steward and opportunity, even though we had these atrocities that happened in every nation, atrocities even happened in the Indian tribes. Atrocities follow men. It doesn't matter. I mean, shoot. Look at the Aztecs. I mean, that was, and as a matter of fact, they're kind of like the base of the Native Americans. My point is that there are atrocities everywhere. But when we looked at how things could have been managed, or we could have migrated the Indians into other places, and it may have been better for a period of time. But I am here to tell you that in America, we still have the opportunity to get things right. In Canada, Britain, or anywhere else, you can't get these things right. And in those days, there were far more atrocities that were being done, especially south of the border. I mean, how would you like it if your entire race became annihilated because it was basically integrated with the occupying host? I mean, all of your women were basically raped to have children. And if you know what the Spaniards did in Mexico to the Indians there, I mean, that's what begot the Mexicans. And so, folks, come on. When we look at how great America wasn't, we weren't as bad as other nations. Britain actually wasn't as bad as other nations. And this is no way to really judge a culture completely. But the point is this, that things would have been so much different had we not been blessed to actually galvanize and forge a way to this point. This actually really helps me, because there's points in time when I actually look at how the 14th Amendment galvanizes and protects everybody's privileges and immunities. Unfortunately, those that are of the descent of the Indian tribes of America, they don't understand that they're protected by that, because they are U.S. citizens. They were and have been under the jurisdiction of the federal government. And so there's no way to unravel, but what you do is you start now. It's just like when we ended slavery. There's no way of unraveling all those atrocities, but there's a way of moving on, freeing ourselves and moving forward. Anyway, let me get back to this. This is where Madison starts to actually go through these points. He says, one, it will prevent those I'll actually start before he leads into this. Proceeding to the consideration of Mr. Patterson's plan, he stated the object of a proper plan to be twofold. One, to preserve the Union, and two, to provide a government that will remedy the evils felt by the states, both in their united and individual capacities. Examine Mr. Patterson's plan and say whether it promises satisfactions in these respects. One, it will prevent those violations of the laws of nations which, if not prevented, must involve the calamities of wars. The tendency of the states to these violations have been manifested in sundry of instances. Now, the files of Congress contain complaints already from most every nation with which treaties have been formed. Hitherto, indulgence has been shown to us. This cannot be the permanent disposition of foreign nations. A rupture with their powers is among the greatest of national calamities. It ought to therefore be effectual, provided that no part of a nation shall have in its power to bring them to the whole. The existing Confederacy does not sufficiently provide against this evil. The proposed amendments to it does not supply the omission. It leaves the will of the states as uncontrolled as ever. Number two, will it prevent the encroachments on the federal authority? A tendency of such encroachments has been sufficiently exemplified. Now, we go into the Federalist Papers and we go into the ratification debates, and because the states were the ones that were encroaching and violating, they didn't think about reversal. They didn't think that they were creating a system that could actually reverse it, because they couldn't imagine that it could be so perverted and redefined, whimsically redefined by the courts. That authority doesn't exist, but somehow they assumed it, because the soothsaying and the wordsmithing and the artistic license and how everybody, it was, if you want to call it a grand conspiracy, if you want to call it a this huge collusion or this huge just facade, they have actually perverted everything to where the federal government couldn't encroach upon the states. They could only protect the citizens from those things within the Constitution, those things that are inalienable rights or what we call civil rights. That's what the 14th Amendment gave us. But anyway, a tendency to such encroachments has been sufficiently exemplified among ourselves as well. In every confederated republic, antient and modern, by the federal articles, transactions with the Indians appertain to Congress, yet in several instances, the states have entered into treaties and wars with them. Huh. Did you know that, folks? Did you know that the states were entering into treaties with the Indians themselves instead of with the articles, with instead of the Union itself or Congress? Now, this was regarding trade, because remember that it was all about assimilating the Indians, and there was this differentiation, because when we look at the Constitution, they didn't create, you know, this autonomy and sovereignty that was this dual sovereignty on American soil. They recognized their right of disassociation. That's all. They did not grant, and as a matter of fact, this is where the whole concept of federal reservations was not in the plan. The plan was to assemble, which is why the Cherokee were doing so well in America. Anyway, let me move on. By the federal articles, transactions with the Indians to appertain to Congress, yet in several of the instances, the states have entered into treaties and wars with them. In like manner, no two or more states can, from among themselves, any treaties, and etc., without the consent of Congress, yet Virginia and Maryland, in one instance, and Pennsylvania and New Jersey in another, have entered into compacts without previous application or subsequent apology. No state, again, can of right raise troops in peacetime without the like consent. Of all cases of the League, this seems to be required the most scrupulous observance. Has not Massachusetts, notwithstanding the most powerful member of the Union, already raised a body of troops? Is she not now augmenting them without having even designed to apprise Congress of her intentions? In fine, have we not seen the public land dealt out to the Connecticut to bribe her acquiescence in the decree constitutionally awarded against her claim on the territory of Pennsylvania? For no other possible mode, it's PENA, P-E-N-A period, so it's an abbreviation, her claim on the territory of Pennsylvania. For no other possible motive can account for the policy of Congress in that measure. If we recur the examples of the Confederacies, we shall find in all of them the same tendencies of the parts to encroach on the authority of the whole. He then reviewed the Acrophatonic and the Achaean Confederacies of the Antients and the Helvetic and the Germanic and the Belgic among the moderns, tracing the analogy to the United States in the Constitution and the extent of the federal authorities in the tendency of the particular members to usurp on these authorities and to bring confusion and ruin the whole. He observed that the plan of Mr. Patterson, besides omitting a control over the states as a general defense of the federal prerogatives, was particularly defective in two of its provisions. One, its ratification was not to be by the people at large, but by the legislatures. It could not be therefore rendered the acts of Congress in pursuance of their powers, even largely paramount to the acts of the states. Two, it gave the federal tribunal an appellate jurisdiction only even in the criminal cases enumerated. The necessity of these such provisions supposed a danger of undue acquittals. In the state tribunals of what could be appellate tribunal, after an acquittal. Besides, in most, if not all of the states, the executives have by their respective constitutions the right of pardons. How could this be taken from them by a legislative ratification only? Three, will it prevent trespasses of the states on each other? Enough has already been seen. He instanced acts of Virginia and Maryland, which give a preference to their own citizens in cases where the citizens of other states are entitled to equality of privileges by the Articles of Confederation. He considered the emissions of paper money and other kind of measures as also aggressions. The states, relatively to one and another, being each of them either debtor or creditor, the creditor states must suffer unjustly from the emission of the debtor states. We have seen retaliating acts on this subject which threaten danger not to the harmony only, but to the tranquility of the Union. The plan of Mr. Patterson, not giving even a negative to the acts of the states, left them as much at liberty as ever to execute their unrighteous projects against each other. Four, will it secure the internal tranquility of the states themselves? The insurrections in Massachusetts admonished all the states of the danger to which they were exposed. Yet the plan of Mr. Patterson contained no provision for supplying the defect of the Confederation on this point. According to the Republican theory, indeed, right and power, being both vested in the majority, are held to be synonymous. According to fact and experience, a minority may, in an appeal, be forced to be overmatched by the majority. One, if the minority happen to include all such as possess the skills and habits of military life with such possessions of great pecuniary resources, one-third may conquer the remaining two-thirds. The one-third of those who participate in the choice of rulers may be rendered a majority by the accession of those whose poverty disqualifies them from a suffrage, and who, for obvious reasons, may be more ready to the standard of sedition than that of the established government. And three, where slavery exists, the Republican theory becomes even more fallacious. Right to the point. Five, will it secure a good internal legislation and administration to the particular states? In developing the evils which vitiate the political system of the United States, it is proper to take into view those which prevail within the states individually as well as those which affect them collectively. Since the former indirectly affect the whole, and there is a great reason to believe that the pressure of them had a full share in the motives which produce the present convention, under this head he enumerated and animadverted on one, the multiplicity of the laws passed by the several states, and two, the mutability of their laws. Three, the injustice of them, and four, the impotence of them, observing that Mr. Patterson's plan contained no remedy for this dreadful class of evils, and could not therefore be received as an adequate provision for the exigencies of the community. Six, he's just pow, pow, pow. He's going through all of these details, and there may be some overlap, but these are each very salient points. Six, will it secure the Union against the influence of foreign powers over its members? He pretended not to say that any such influence had yet been tried, but it was naturally to be expected that occasions would produce it. as lessons which claimed particular attention, he cited the intrigues practiced among the Amphitonic confederates, first by the kings of Persia and afterwards fatally by Philip of Macedon. Among the ancients, first by the Macedons and afterwards no fatally less by Rome, among the Swiss, by Austria, France, and the lesser neighboring powers, among the members of the Germanic body of France, England, Spain, and Russia, and the Belgic republics, by all the great neighboring powers. The plan of Mr. Patterson not giving the general councils any negative on the will of the particular states left the door open from the like perniciousness and the machinations among ourselves. You know, one of the things, just taking aside here, and actually I've got 3 minutes left, and I do not have time to finish this last, this next one, number 7 and 8. He goes on and on and on. This goes a long ways. And so one of the things I've noticed is the way they kind of just speak, you know, briefly over some of the history that these men understood. These were very well-educated men regarding history, regarding civics, regarding governance and laws, and, you know, the international or the nat, I should say, the laws of nations and those types of things. Now, they had the ability to immerse themselves because their time and their world was much simpler than ours today. They don't have to understand the combustion engine. They don't have to understand, you know, all of these ways of functioning and operating within our society, whether it's traveling on the road and traveling on the rail and public transportation. I mean, all the forms of transportation. Back in those days, it was a horse. Back in those days, life was very simple so that they could get very complex into the intricacies of history, government, laws, you know, and how they failed, how governments failed, how they succeeded, the flaws within some of their successes, because nothing was perfect. Nothing. No government was perfect. Not even, you know, the rule of judges in Israel. And I don't mean that it wasn't perfect. It could have been. But it wasn't perfect for Israel because Israel had to have a king. It took 400 years for them to get to that point. So in other words, it may have been perfect and it operated, you know, very well for a long time. But the people perverted themselves. And it's one of the few governments that of, and it wasn't a self-government, it was a theocracy. And Israel was always a theocracy. And here's the thing. We will get to a point where we will live under theocracy when he comes again. But I will not allow a theocracy until he comes. At least I will not submit myself to a theocracy until he comes. Because no man that's alive today or even been alive back in those days, and unless he is at the head, and that's the trapping. We get people, oh, this person is righteous, this is a prophet, a man of God, or what have you. We're living in the days of deception. We need to live, pray, and wait for him when it comes to a theocracy. So until then, we have his constitution that I believe is the foundation of liberty, and I believe it is going to be the foundation of government under his rule. There's no doubt in my mind that, you know, these fundamental principles are what his governance will be based on. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.